Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 299. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about Tartars and Tsars and, of course, Red Square as we go to European Russia. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into this week's interview, I do have three news stories for you. In the first one, if you're going to Wisconsin, you might want to pick up your cheese map. The Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board has a map of the state with 116 different cheesemakers and retail stores. And you may think I'm kidding, but actually, I remember going to a dairy and getting fresh cheese when I was in Wisconsin as a child, and I honestly would recommend it. And then if you're under 13 years of age, the rules for security for you just got a little easier in the United States. The Homeland Security Secretary Janet Neapolitano told Congress on Tuesday that young children will not be involved in pat-downs that involve touching private areas on the body, and also they don't have to take off their shoes. And then in slightly weirder news, there is a new business in divorce hotels. Couples who choose to end their marriage in a luxury hotel. So first there was the honeymoon, and then the baby moon, and now the divorce moon. For links to all three of those stories, check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome back to the show Francis Tapon, who's come back to talk to us about Western Russia. Francis, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Chris.
And I say welcome back because you were on not all that long ago talking to us about Albania.
That's right. Yeah. It was now we're talking about a less obscure country.
Less obscure in some ways, although not that many more Americans really get a chance to go to Russia, especially to the part that we're talking about. And I don't know that everybody even thinks of it as Europe, but your book, Hidden Europe, where you're focusing on what we've often called Eastern Europe or now Central Europe to Eastern Europe, this is one of the countries that you've been traveling around in recently.
Yeah, that's right. And you're right that for most people, Russia is basically two cities. It's either Moscow or St. Petersburg.
Right.
Yeah. So the rest of Russia is pretty much unknown to a lot of travelers. In fact, it's probably even unknown to a lot of Russians.
Why should we go there? And what area are we talking about, first of all? Let's scope the problem.
West of the Ural Mountains. So the Ural Mountains is a mountain range that runs north to south. And it's a few hours, actually almost a day's journey, almost 24-hour train ride from the Moscow. So it's pretty far away from Moscow, but it geographically marks the eastern edge of the European continent.
Right. Historically, we've ended Europe there, although I'm not sure that everybody has included Russia when they think of Europe.
That's right.
So other than the two big cities, where else should we go? What kind of itinerary would you recommend for European Russia, basically, is what we're talking about?
Yeah, I would say four places. Of course, you got to go with the St. Petersburg and Moscow, which are obviously wonderful, amazing cities, especially St. Petersburg, I think I would put that number one on the list. It's truly divine. The other two are much more obscure, but still great. One is Kazan, and the other one is Kaliningrad, which is in a very hidden part of Europe.
Kaliningrad?
Yeah, Kaliningrad.
I don't know that one at all.
Yeah, Kaliningrad is, it's funny because it's basically right in Europe as Europe proper. It's sandwiched between Lithuania and Poland. So it's what's called an exclave. In other words, just like You look at Alaska, which is kind of disconnected from the United States, the rest of the contiguous United States. Kaliningrad is also one of these kind of, it's a state, it belongs to Russia, and yet it's not connected to the rest of the motherland.
Interesting.
When you look at a map and you see where Kaliningrad is, you kind of wonder, like, what happened to this? How did this thing just happen? Because you kind of think that, why didn't the people in Kaliningrad overthrow the Soviet government and become independent? And the reason they didn't become independent is, well, they felt that they're Russians fundamentally, just like Alaskans feel like they're Americans for the most part.
Interesting. So let's go back over those and go in a little more detail. What order do you want to tackle them?
I guess we can start with my order of preference. I guess we can start with St. Petersburg.
Okay. So we're going to go to the Hermitage, and then most people get back on the cruise ship and go away.
That's right, yeah. One of the bargains I think that's still available, it's not nearly as good as it was 10 years ago when I first went to Russia, is the fact that you can go to see ballet, which is pretty affordable still, compared to, let's say, a New York performance. Although it's different now in Moscow and the Bolshoi Theater, it's pretty much almost at basically at parity with New York prices. But I saw a ballet both in the Bolshoi Theater in Moscow as well as in St. Petersburg. And it's a great destination. It's a great thing because, of course, most people who are going to go there don't speak Russian fluently. That is most people who are listening to this podcast. And so for them, you know, you can watch ballet and enjoy it. And it's ballet in Russia is the best in the world.
I've certainly heard that, mostly from Russians, but certainly they would be telling the truth about that. Let's start with when we should go to St. Petersburg. We're talking about a city that is a port city, but not ice-free some parts of the year.
That's right, yeah. It's way up north, and it's right next to Estonia and Finland. And so I think you can, I mean, of course you can go any time of the year. It keeps functioning as a city. It's got, I think, 4 million people or so. But the problem is that, of course, it gets very dark during the winter time. So I would limit it to probably about the 6 months a year, roughly around, centered around the summertime. Because then you get these long nights. I was lucky to go there once during what's called the White Nights, which is during the summer solstice.
I remember that movie. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's great because, of course, the city, you know, you practically, it doesn't get truly, truly dark even at 2 o'clock in the morning. It still has a little twilight there.
Okay. A historical city built by Peter the Great, named after him again, although wasn't there for a while.
Right. It was a swampland for a long time. And so, and what he did is that he took a bunch of serfs, basically indentured servitude, and forced them, and lots of people died just the same way, like, well, a few centuries later when we tried to build the Panama Canal, there's lots of people who died of malaria. Well, there was malaria and issues up in St. Petersburg at the time, and all sorts of other hard labor stuff. So it was built in a tough way, but it turned out to be a beautiful city, and he invited a bunch of Western European architects to help design some of the buildings, and it turned out to be precious. So really, I think a lot of Westerners, some of us have an association with Russia as having this communist architecture, which is kind of, in general, blockish and gray and unattractive for most people. And yet St. Petersburg has a much more classical architecture, which makes it much more pleasing to the eye. And plus, it's got all these canals that crisscross through it, which is why it gets its name, the Venice of the North, because it has these canals that really add a lot of personality to the city. And so it makes it quite attractive just to walk through.
I was going to say, I remember that when they built it, they were actually constructing it on piles similar to Venice, which is also built in a swamp. I wasn't sure how much of that was still obvious today, though.
It's not. Okay. I mean, the canals are still there, but it doesn't have the exact same feel as Venice because there are cars everywhere. And so it has that aspect to it. But still, it's great.
Excellent. Anything else we should see while we're in, and I wanted to call it Leningrad, but just momentarily I went back to the name from my youth. Of course, it was there for much of my life. It was Leningrad.
That's right. Yeah, they changed it actually almost exactly 20 years ago. That's when they officially changed their name. But I would go to the Peterhof, which is one of the big castles that Peter the Great had. And it's a beautiful classic castle. Think of it like a Versailles, but, you know, way out in Russia. And it's a UNESCO site and pretty spectacular as well.
Okay. Anything else?
Well, I mean, again, there's lots of things to see, but I prefer talking about the more obscure parts.
Great. Then let's move on.
Yeah.
Where do we go next?
I would say Moscow. I mean, I list Moscow because it's the biggest, most populated city in Europe. And you've got to go there just because it is. It is Moscow, and it is really the center of Russia. And one of the ways that I think is kind of funny that they kind of demonstrate that it is the center of Russia is that all the train stations in Russia. Okay, first of all, Russia has, I believe, 9 time zones.
It used to be 12, as I recall, before in the days of the Soviet Union. So
you're right, but I think now it's down to 9. I'll double check that. But basically, all the train stations, no matter what, have Moscow time on their clocks, which can be very confusing. And also, when they print you the ticket on the train, it says, let's say, 20 hours. So of course, military time. And then you look at your clock and your clock may say it's 21 hours and you say, well, wait a second, I just missed my train. It's, oh, no, that's Moscow time. So it can be a little bit confusing.
And first of all, in terms of getting from St. Petersburg to Moscow, flying, taking a river is actually the other option, and taking the train, what do you recommend?
I think, I haven't done the river option, so I shouldn't say that I don't recommend it. It sounds like a beautiful idea. But I think that for me, the train option I love is great because, first of all, you get to experience the whole Russian train system, which is actually pretty good, especially because you can take these overnight journeys, which are pretty comfortable. And they time the train, the speed and everything. So it basically lasts, I think, roughly around 8 hours or so. So you get a good night's sleep. And then you wake up and boom, you're either in St. Petersburg or Moscow, depending on which direction you're going. So I like that just because to me, it feels like a teleportation device. You can just basically get to bed and wake up and boom, there you are in Moscow. And it's relatively inexpensive. And you can ride in different classes of vehicles. And it's very safe. And best of all, you get to meet some of the locals and you get to see a lot of people who do this commute on a fairly regular basis. So I think it's probably the most exciting and fun way to go there. And it's also an affordable way. By the way, it is 9 time zones. I just checked.
Okay. And you mentioned that Moscow is the center of Russia, not geographically, but culturally. And it seems like it's also the center of a lot of the new things that are going on. You mentioned that the price of the ballet has gone up there. And I think a lot of prices have gone up because there's a lot more the new money that's going into Moscow, is my impression.
You're absolutely right. It is a lot of money that came in, especially after the privatization. And you have, after the Soviet Union fell 20 years ago, by the way, in December of 2011, we have the 20th anniversary of the fall of the USSR. So it's a big event that marked the transition to capitalism. And in the process, some people got very, very rich. And also there was another factor. It's the fact that the oil prices have generally gone up, especially in the last few years.
Right.
And since most of the economy is based on natural gas and oil, the majority of there is that a lot of people then are living and the prices all go up. And that has impacted Moscow more than any other city, especially for housing. It's incredibly high. It's extremely expensive to be there, and certainly you won't feel much of a difference between any other major city in the world.
Okay. Anything else we want to do in Moscow before we move on to some of your favorite locations?
Well, I mean, there's the classic things to see in Moscow, like the Kremlin, of course, that people should see. I think one of the more fun things is just going to the subway, actually. Subway is enormous. It's the second biggest in the world, I think, after Tokyo. And so it's just the city under there. And some of the stations are actually really designed in a cool way. Some of them are back in the 1950s, kind of Stalinish, which is interesting. Some of them are a little bit more modern. It's just an interesting world just down underneath the ground of Moscow as well to go explore.
Okay.
Kazan.
And let's put Kazan on a map.
Okay. Kazan is a few hours to the east of Moscow. So you just get on a train and off you go. And it's the capital of Tartarstan. And Tartars are these an ethnic group of people who have their own language, and they kind of have a, it's not a Turkish background, but it's Asian background. And they have their own language and their own alphabet, and their language is kind of like Turkish. It's a Turkic language. And they use the Cyrillic alphabet, and they tend to be Muslims. And they're capital is Kazan, and it's not that far. You know, it's about 500 miles east of Moscow by 800 kilometers, and it's right on the Volga River, and it has just over 1 million people who live there. And the reason I like it and I suggest it is a couple of things. Number one, first of all, just recently they celebrated their 1,000-year anniversary as a city, And as a result, they invested a lot of money to kind of beautify it. And so now it has a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It looks really pretty in that respect. And they have this brand new mosque that has a blue roof and is kind of monolithic and dramatic. And it's also worth seeing, and anybody can enter it, by the way. And it's a little bit off the beaten path, and that makes it also interesting. So you get a little bit of a cultural side, because a lot of times people think of Russians as a certain type of European that's just Christian or Orthodox, right? Versus the Tatars, which have a different cultural background. And yet they're coexisting for centuries right there, not far from Moscow, relatively not far in Russian standards.
And I want to say, now, was it the Tatars or the Mongols who took over what we now think of Russia in around 1066, right around the same time as the Norman conquest?
That was the Mongol invasion that first went in there. Yeah.
And those two were kind of linked, because the last people they defeated before they invaded Russia, as I recall, were the Tatars. So that's why I was confusing the two.
That's right. And there is a little bit of tension ethnically between the Tatars and some of the other Russians. But overall, I mean, they coexist pretty peacefully. And by the way, in 2018, they're going to be hosting one of the World Cup soccer matches. So I think Kazan will come on the map for a lot of people in 2018 when the World Cup, some of the matches are held there.
Okay.
And the architecture I thought was also kind of interesting, because they're right by the Volga. So he's got this nice, beautiful river there, and they have these, 16th century and cathedral there, and you have this mosque nearby. But at the same time, like not that far away, you have this kind of glass pyramid that kind of looks like the Luxor pyramid that you see in Las Vegas. And it's pretty much right there in the middle of the city.
The Louvre pyramid.
That too, except it's more opaque, glass. It's not like the Louvre exactly. I would say it's more like the Luxor, which has this kind of black.
Right,
right. It's basically a nightclub.
Okay.
But it's just funny that it's this mishmash of the. And one of the more claim to fame that Kazan has is that it's where Vladimir Lenin was educated. In fact, they have probably one of the few statues in the world where you can see a statue of Lenin that doesn't really look like Lenin, with that sharp nose and the bald head and the sharp chin. You kind of have to take a double take and say, who the hell is that? And then you look up and you say, oh, it's Lenin when he was like 20 years old.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. So, and you can go there and see a circus for inexpensive price and that kind of stuff. But again, I guess what I'm getting at, Chris, is that there's two types of travelers, or at least travel itineraries. And one is to kind of go to places that have the typical beautiful architecture and nice to look at cities like the Venice and Berlin or Paris and those types of cities, versus cities that are more cultural. So just like Russians who come to America, they hit the big cities like D.C. and New York and San Francisco. But there's some Russians out there who want to go to Nebraska or North Dakota. Now, we all know that there's not that much to see in Nebraska, North Dakota. But for the Russian, that's a really interesting cultural experience.
Right.
To go to Kentucky is a different experience. That, in fact, a lot of even Americans haven't even been to Oklahoma and experienced what it's like to be in Oklahoma. But it shows a different side of the country. And so that's why I encourage, when you go to Russia, don't just go to St. Petersburg and Moscow. Get a little bit away from those places and go check out something else. You're going to see another thing. In fact, I would highly encourage there's some villages along the way. Now, back in the Soviet time, a lot of these villages, not a lot, but almost all these villages would be off limits to Westerners, because you would have to be guided and escorted by the KGB.
Right.
But nowadays, these villages, you can go there, and some of them have these little rinky-dink hotels that you can stay at. And maybe even through couch surfing, you could probably find yourself a host. But the bottom line is, it will show you a side of Russia that very few people have seen. Now, the challenge, of course, is that if you don't speak Russian, you're going to find it very hard to get around. But you can. And sometimes Russians can be a little bit gruff at times. But if you've got your little guidebook and you've got your at least some choice phrases that you can show them, you can get by. And that's what I did. I speak only basic Russian. I could get by in a lot of these places by myself. And it just shows you another side of the country that I think is unique. So for those people who want that kind of experience, there's a lot of places to go to in Russia.
Yeah, my Russian is also not that good. Я понимаю по-русски не очень хорошо. But what sort of things do we need to... So we're really going to get in touch with the Russian culture more or at least a portion of the Russian culture. We shouldn't assume it's one culture. That's the other thing I think that you're really pointing out, is that Russia is a lot more complex than we might think.
Exactly. And we're just talking in this podcast, we're just talking about the Western.
Right. We haven't even talked about Siberia. We haven't gone off to Kamchatka or...
Yeah, Kamchatka, and not even down a little bit south, down to the Chechen area.
Right, sure. What sort of things should I know before I go there in terms of, we've got a language barrier, but in terms of cultural barriers, what kind of things are going to surprise me?
For an American, I think the first thing, and I'll be blunt about this, is that Russians don't smile, at least not in a customer service situation. Of course, when you meet, if you go to meet a Russian family and you get to know people, of course, they smile. But in general, they've got a pretty serious look on their face most of the time. And sometimes the customer service can actually suck. And so it's one thing that you got to mentally prepare yourself, is that you're not necessarily going to get a lot of smiles. And sometimes, actually, Russians take pride in this. They say, okay, well, we're not going to give you a fake smile, mister.
Right.
You know, if we smile, it's that we mean it. We're not here to, like, give you a little fake American smile. And so this is the way we are. And we're real people. And so that's fine. But for an American tourist, that's kind of at first shocking, and sometimes could be even be offensive or off-putting if all of a sudden you go and ask for help even at your hotel, and they're not cheery to help you, and maybe they make you wait or whatever. And so that's, I think, the biggest cultural shock, I think, for Americans to come there, besides, of course, the language and the fact that the Cyrillic alphabet is another shocker. By the way, and I guess we should just mention briefly, the Cyrillic is kind of weird for Americans, for people who know the Latin alphabet, because a lot of the letters seem similar, and yet they're pronounced quite differently.
Right, sure. And it's a little closer, obviously, if you know some Greek, because St.
Yes.
Cyril took Greek characters when he didn't have the right characters to fill in for the extra sounds he had in Russian. But
right. Exactly right. Yeah. But few people speak Greek.
Right. Well, and my problem with Greek is, being an engineer, I always want to solve it instead of pronounce it. So that's not something that most people will run into. But.
Right.
And when you talk about the service culture, and that's something we hear a lot after the Iron Curtain fell, now that's been quite a while, that any country sort of to the left, or to the right rather, of the Iron Curtain, to the east of there, didn't have that culture of service. I mean, back in the communist days, it was, we pretend to work and they pretend to pay us. And so there really wasn't a great incentive for a service culture. Do you see that more, for instance, in Moscow? I would expect to see that different from Kazan at this point.
Yeah, it is.
Not so much.
Yeah, but it's not a huge difference, okay, frankly. Even in Kaliningrad, which we still haven't talked about, it's the same basic mentality. It's finding hard to get rid of it. It's just the problem with monopolies. I mean, if you think about in American society, when you're dealing with a monopoly, i.e. the
cable company, the phone company,
the government,
sure, yeah.
The government tends to not be very friendly and nice either, because you have to go to them. You don't have a choice. You got to get your permit to build your house from this one guy, and that's the only guy who's going to give you the permit. You can't go somewhere else to get it
right,
done.
Sure.
So as a result, they have this. It comes from a monopoly mentality. And in fact, even Dmitry Medvedev, who is the current president of Russia, he even say, and I'm going to quote, he says that Russia has to face the world with a smiling face. He said, quote, "They should not gnash its teeth at anyone, get angry, sulk, or feel offended," unquote. So even the president is admitting to some extent publicly that they have a tendency to kind of get angry or gnash their teeth and get offended and this kind of stuff. And he's kind of making a call to the country that, hey, we need to reform this. And the Chinese did the same thing when they prepared for the 2008 Olympics.
Right.
They had to kind of train their people to smile and to do this, and because it wasn't just culturally the norm. And so this is part of the thing. I'm not saying it's good or bad. It's just that's the way it is.
Well, and I used to hear the saying happen in Russia that life is hard, but it's short. But I haven't been able to verify that with anybody I've worked with who is from Russia, so I don't know that that's a real saying. But it does capture somewhat. There has traditionally been a life is hard kind of life in much of Russia, certainly in the peasant class before, or the serf class, not that long before that. It wasn't an easy life. And so I think some of that is obviously coming out of that.
That is correct. And at the same time, there's, you know, you have such extremes in Russia where you can easily find people, once you get to know them, that they're just ridiculously friendly and they'll open up their homes to you and they'll stuff vodka down your throat. And
that was the other cultural thing that I was wondering if you had mentioned. Yeah. Okay.
And they really go great on their hospitality once they feel comfortable with you. And so that's certainly the case. And I think also there's developing a little bit of a two-tier system in Russia now, because you've got this younger generation which is starting to learn English, and they're still a minority. I mean, everybody learns English in school officially, but you ask young people on the streets, you still find it hard to people who actually speak English well enough to have a conversation. They might know how to say right, left, straight, but they may not have a deep, profound conversation or follow what we're saying right now. But there is getting this divide between the richer society who are educated, who know a lot, and those who are kind of still stuck in the old ways of doing things or who haven't had a chance to perfect and open up their minds to seeing how the globalization is affecting the world and have a chance to learn English as well as others or any other language for that matter. They're still kind of insular in that sense.
Sure.
So it really comes down to what kind of Russians you hang out with while you're there. But it's, I guess you could say the same thing about America too.
Mm-hmm. Well, until 20 years ago, there was a lot of the world that if they were learning a second language, it wasn't English, it was Russian. So that's a fairly big change to when things changed. I think that was one of the things that did. So
that's right. Yeah.
Now you've got one more destination you want to mention before we get into some of the more general questions.
Sure. Kaliningrad is, as I mentioned before, it's kind of nestled. It's this tiny little place that's nestled right between Lithuania and Poland, northern Poland. It's fairly near to Gdańsk, if you know where Gdańsk is in Poland. Now, unfortunately, you still need a visa to get to Kaliningrad, even though it's kind of seems disconnected. And why can't we just drive through Kaliningrad? It's right next, you know, just go from Poland right into it.
Well, and you need a visa to get to Russia, period, as I recall.
That's right. If you're an American, you need a visa. In fact, any Europeans, the only ones that don't need are people who are in kind of near the ex-Soviet Union. A lot of South Americans don't need a visa for Russia either. But yeah, pretty much EU people and Americans, they need visas. And they're expensive. It costs about the cheapest visa, it costs about $140. Mm-hmm. And so, again, just to go to Kaliningrad, you can get this. And so that's a one-entry visa. I think actually a two-entry visa is also about $140. And if you need it express, it's going to be like $250.
And I have run into people who've had trouble getting the visa when they were not in their home country also.
I haven't had that problem because I got my Russian visas, I guess. One time I got it in the United States. One time I got it when I was in Estonia.
Okay.
So I didn't have that problem there. But maybe in a different, depending on the countries it is. I mean, you got to remember that sometimes it can take up to around 3 weeks sometimes to get a visa. Hmm. So make sure you don't have to pay through the nose to get one. But they have made the process better than before. You can just go online to the RussianEmbassy.org and download the forms, fill them out. You got to create a little account and pay the fees. And now it's a little bit easier than it used to be a few years ago. And it's been cheaper even for EU citizens, since some of the people who are listening to this podcast might be in the EU or have EU citizenship. It's only 50 euros, which is works out to be about roughly $75, I think.
Interesting.
So about half the price of the US pays. So that's another benefit that they just recently, that happened in July of 2011.
Interesting.
Where they lowered the visa requirements for EU citizens and made it a lot easier for EU citizens to go.
Kaliningrad.
It's a tiny place. And again, the main thing that I find interesting, again, is more from a cultural perspective. Mm-hmm. It used to be part of the German Empire, if you will, or whatever, the German culture. If you go back a few hundred years, Kaliningrad was Königsberg.
So it was in the Hanseatic League?
It was probably part of the Hanseatic League, I believe so, but it was definitely part of Prussia. It was, in fact, for a long time, Königsberg was the capital of Prussia until they finally moved Prussia's capital to Berlin. So it's kind of weird if you look at a map to think that kind of the center of gravity, the capital of Germany, or at least Prussia, was in Kaliningrad. And then what happened was after World War One, they lost a big chunk of it, and then Hitler tried to get it all back, and he only got it back for a few years. And then when Russia came and pushed them out after World War II, they pushed all of them out. So Kaliningrad, that territory, used to be 95% German. Almost everybody there was German, right up to 1945. And then after 1945, the Russians came and says, well, you know, get into a train and get out of here, or, you know, face execution. So basically everybody had to leave. And they had this big real estate empty. And so they just imported a bunch of Russians to move into these empty German houses and fill up the German real estate, which would now had become Russian. So what happened was, and that's different than what happened in the Baltic states, because the Baltic states had their own ethnic groups there, which Russians didn't seem as enemies. You know, they had the Estonians, Latvians, and Lithuanians, who were their own cultures, and but they hadn't fought against Russia for the most part during World War II, and so they weren't given the boot. And plus, there were a lot more of them. So that's kind of explains the strange result of Kaliningrad, and that's why culturally it's 100% Russian. They don't have a strange accent of Russian. They speak Russian just like every other Russian. So what's interesting about Kaliningrad is that even though now they only have about 1% Germans that are there, less than 1%, a lot of the Germanic architecture still exists. And so you have this interesting overlap of different architecture and a kind of different style. And I think also the pace is a little bit slower than you'll find in, let's say, St. Petersburg and Moscow. And one of the things about it that I think is also interesting is that it used to be completely closed. It was a military installation for throughout the whole Cold War. So it was completely off limits, absolutely off limits to any Westerner. And so that's one of the cool things, again, for those travelers who want to get a little bit off the beaten path, and yet you're not that far away from Europe. Like I said, Poland's right next door. You can go into Kaliningrad and see a piece of Europe that had been hidden for throughout the entire Cold War period, and frankly, is still now largely hidden. Few people actually still go there.
Interesting. And I hadn't clued in, it took me just a little while there, that when you were talking about this, so we were talking about what was formerly East Prussia, and at the start of World War II, for instance, was an island of Germany out in that area, and now is an island of Russia out in the West. So
that's right. Yeah, it's always been this kind of figurative island, just so the listeners don't get confused. It's not really an island, but
right.
We're just talking we're figuratively talking an island.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just like Alaska is an island out there, or for the United States. Yeah, you're right. It's just a little tiny strategic military thing, and it's still that's where the Baltic fleet for Russia is established. Mm-hmm. It's their only year-round ice-free port. And so strategically, it's a very important place. I guess they also have a place down in the Crimea.
Black Sea, but yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Black Sea. But up in the north, that's their only ice-free port.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the day that we find out about Kaliningrad, the world finds out about Kaliningrad, is not going to be a good day, because that's the day when all of a sudden Russia decides for whatever reason to put missiles there, probably in retaliation because the United States decides to point a bunch of missiles at Russia or put some sort of missile defense system that gets the Russian government upset, that they'll say, fine, you want to do that? We'll go ahead and we'll put Russian missiles right here in in Kaliningrad. And that's when all of a sudden people will know where the hell that place is. But other than that, it's a pretty quiet place. It has some, you know, decent beaches. You know, it's not going to compete against the Caribbean, but it's for the Baltic Sea. They're pretty pristine beaches that you can go to. And I guess one of the highlights in Kaliningrad is, I'm going to mispronounce it, the Koronian Spit, which is a UNESCO site. And think of it as a very long, skinny, thin, it's only about 2 football fields, 3 football fields wide. And yet it goes on for miles and kilometers. And it creates a lagoon on one side, and it's got the Baltic Sea on the other side. So think of it as like this long, long bridge that stretches from Kaliningrad all the way out to Lithuania. And you have water on both sides of this long, thin strip. And it's great. I was there actually ice fishing. I didn't go there ice fishing, but I found some ice fishermen there in February. So I was touring around Kaliningrad there. You go out to the lagoon and you walk out there, and there's some Russian ice fishermen there. But I was also in that same area in Lithuania during the summer and looking the other way, south. It's a beautiful area. They have lots of sand dunes. Again, it's totally pristine. And you just feel like you're in this hidden place of Europe. That's, I guess, the most fun part about it. As a tourist who's been all over Europe and you think you know Europe in the back of your hand, go to Kaliningrad and you're going to see a side of Europe that you're like, whoa, I had no idea this place existed. it's not the best thing ever. It's not like, wow, you know, the Kaliningrad, the capital Kaliningrad, is nothing like that beautiful. It has some cool remnant, but it was obliterated during World War II.
Sure.
And so they have a great amber museum. They produce more amber than any place else in the world. And so it has a strong amber tradition. And so you can get that for a cheap price. But I think, again, the most fascinating thing is just being able to go out and explore these places that few Europeans have even seen.
So thinking of all four destinations you've mentioned, what's the best day you've had in European Russia?
Oh, wow. I guess I got two good days. One was when I went that ice fishing experience I told you about in Kaliningrad. Mm-hmm. It was just fun because I just wasn't expecting this. I didn't know what to see. And I had this cat who was kind of following me out onto the lagoon for a few meters and then finally got chicken and went back. And I just felt like I was on the moon. You know, you can imagine in February walking across this huge, huge, expansive lagoon that you cannot even see the edge of it on the other side. And you're just walking on ice. And I don't even know if the ice is thick enough to hold me. And eventually I kept walking and walking and walking. And eventually I saw these tiny little people out in the distance. And I was like, oh my God, they're in the middle of the lagoon. And I kept walking toward them. It took me about a kilometer to get there. And then I spoke our basic Russian. We just hung out there for about half an hour, and then it was too cold. But these guys were totally set up, and it was just a fun experience to go there and see the site. The second part that I really had an interesting experience is a place that we haven't really talked about, which is right on the Ural Mountains. I had this dream that I really wanted to go to the easternmost point of Europe, mm-hmm. right on the Ural Mountains. And there's a town called Yekaterinburg, which is all the way just on the east side of the Ural Mountains. It's the fourth biggest city in Russia. And yet very few people have been there. It's officially in Asia, but it's the closest place you can get to right on the border. And you can take this little bus up and stand right at the top of the Ural Mountains on the crest. And they have a monument there that shows that this is the border between Europe and Asia. And so it was just fun for me, just as my kind of dream. It's nothing special for maybe going way out of your way to go there. But for me, it was fun to just put one foot in Asia, one foot in Europe, and kind of complete this dream of really seeing all of Eastern Europe and getting all the way to the easternmost point and experiencing that. So that was fun. Yekaterinburg as a city, like I said, it's just in Asia, barely. But it's still interesting for those who want to go out there to see where the Tsars of Russia were assassinated. The last Tsars, Nicholas, was assassinated right there. And they have a church where he was assassinated as well. You can go see where they were buried, because after they were assassinated, they were burnt and acid was thrown on their bones and they were buried in a forest. Well, that place, they found it recently, about 20 years ago or so. They found where they were buried exactly, and they've set up some monasteries around there, that burial site as well. So for that historical visit is an interesting place to go as well.
Okay. So we've talked about some places that people probably haven't heard of, and we've talked about some better known places, Moscow and St. Petersburg. Are there places that are better known that all the guidebooks say go there and you say pass?
Well, I mean, I'm going to be kind of contradictory here. I'm going to say Moscow.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I realize I'm completely contradicting myself in some ways, but I'm just saying that Moscow is a great, great city, but I would still put other places in Russia as more interesting. Moscow has the museums, and you got to go to see that. It has the Kremlin, all that stuff. But in some ways, for me, Moscow is a little bit disappointing because it's not as great as one would expect. I mean, I guess maybe when you walk into Russia, you have these just enormous expectations that the capital is just going to absolutely blow you away. And aside from the Kremlin itself, it's not as wow, you know, blow you away as you might expect. Let's compare it to other Western European cities that your listeners are familiar with. You know, let's say London or Paris or there you can, after you go to the city center, you can get around and start seeing lots of cool things. In Moscow, maybe it's my fault. I've only been there three times, so maybe I need to explore it even more. But I just don't get it as deep of a sense as it can be. But having said that, of course, almost all trains go to Moscow, all flights go into Moscow. So if you're going to be there, you should check it out.
Okay. One warning you would give about going to Russia?
I would say, again, just it's a warning about the issue of the friendliness. It's more of like an expectations game. And just to expect that when you're dealing with customer service people, set your expectations really low. And don't expect happy-go-lucky friendly service all the time. You will get it. It does exist, and I think it's happening more and more. But if you have low expectations, you won't be disappointed. The other kind of warning I would say they have in Moscow and probably other cities too, gypsy cabs. And what these are is they're private citizens who spontaneously become taxi cab drivers. And you go in there and you negotiate the fare right before you get in. The advantage of gypsy cabs, number one, they're everywhere, effectively, and more prevalent than regular taxis. And they're significantly cheaper, probably about half the price of a regular taxi. But I took one late at night, and the guy actually ripped me off. He took my wallet. So it's a long story, but bottom line is I write about it in my book, and it's a kind of a funny story, like all these kind of disaster stories are in retrospect. But it's something you should just be a little bit cautious of, is just jumping into any old gypsy cab. I think if you go there, it's okay to take gypsy cabs, but either go with a Russian speaker, or at least you're there with a travel buddy. If there's two of you, I think it's much safer. But if you're solo by yourself and you don't speak much Russian, don't do what I did. And, you know, jump in the first random gypsy cab you run into.
Okay. You talked about having trouble connecting to the locals and some of the service culture. Is there someone, though, that you did make a connection with that really left an impression on you?
When I stayed in Kaliningrad, I stayed with he was an engineer and a trader, actually. He traded stocks, financial trader, and it was through couchsurfing that I stayed with him. And again, the fun thing is that he didn't speak that much English, but we were able to communicate through using books and maps. And he was able to communicate in a basic way, share all the history of Kaliningrad. And he also had an 8-year-old son, and, you know, just great hospitality. He was living in basically a studio apartment with his 8-year-old son. He was not married, and I guess he's divorced. And I stayed in the same room, so he slept with the son, and he gave me the option to sleep in the kitchen. But, you know, we're all three of us there. And, you know, it's great. This man who's probably around 40 years old, he let me into his house, and we shared meals. And I brought some food, and he brought some food, and we kind of cooked up together. It was a great experience, and felt well connected with him. And this happened also in St. Petersburg as well. I visited some villages, and I guess before we end, I should mention that if you have a chance to go to these villages, I went to Polonoye, which is a tiny village. You won't even find it practically on the map. It's near Porkov, which is near Pskov, which is near Estonia. But anyway, it's a tiny little place. And again, you know, just meeting with these Russians. And if you can somehow go there with a Russian speaker, it's great, because then all of a sudden you can get the translation from all the babushkas and all the people who are the older generation people, because those are the people who are really going to give you the great stories and give you a great picture of Russia and a great historical perspective of Russia, is to hang out with the Russians who are in the older generation, people who are above 50 years old. Those guys are the ones who have the best stories, and that's what I really enjoyed doing. And it was great research for my book. I really enjoyed connecting with the older generation.
Excellent. And we'll talk a little bit about your book in a bit. Anything else, though, before we get to our final three questions that people should know before they go to Russia, European Russia especially?
I would say that, I mean, just get your visa stuff all in order. I think a lot of times people might look at a map and just think, oh, we can just go to Russia just as easy as we can go to Poland. And it's not the same. So just get all that organization up there before you go out and plan that side of things first.
Okay. Last three questions. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Russia.
when you go to any kind of customer service situation, you know, either a restaurant or whatever, and just that you try to crack a smile, you try to make a joke, and they just still won't laugh. It's just incredible. Like, sometimes I go in there with a challenge, like, I'm going to make this person smile. I'm going to make them crack a smile. I'm going to do it. And I still can't do it. I'm like, damn it, only in Russia.
And finish this sentence. You really know you're in Russia when what?
When you can't find an English speaker. Finding sometimes English speakers can be challenging in Russia. And so that's one of the sides. And the other way you know you're in Russia is when all the clocks are on Moscow time. And I suppose another way that you know you're in Russia is that it's going to take you a few days just to go to the next city or whatever. Not days, but at least many, many hours. I mean, it's just people don't know the scale of Russia. It's just really, really hard to digest the size of Russia. In America, we think that our country is big, and of course it is, but Russia is almost twice the size. It's 1.8 times bigger, even when you throw in Alaska. Right. So it's just mind-bogglingly big. It just goes on forever. You know you're in Russia when all of a sudden you look at a map and you say, oh, I just got to go here. It doesn't look that far. And all of a sudden you're like, wow, it's actually a whole day's journey away.
Right. And finally, if you had to sum up European Russia in three words, what three words would you use?
Enormous, mm-hmm. dynamic, and I feel like it's a little bit like the Wild West to a certain extent. Hmm. It feels like probably America did in the 19th century in some way. There's a sense of vibrancy. There's a certain amount of entrepreneurship that's starting to happen. And there's, of course, there's a depressive side that people are kind of complaining a lot. But there's kind of a resurgence in Russia that's different than you felt, let's say, in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. And so that aspect is also something that stands out. So vibrancy and a kind of a wild westness.
Excellent. Now, you've mentioned the book a couple times, and we just gave it a brief mention in the beginning. Tell us a little more about Hidden Europe.
The Hidden Europe is a travelogue based on my travels. I spent about 3 years traveling nonstop all over Eastern Europe. And I define Eastern Europe quite broadly, 25 countries. So there's 25 chapters, one chapter per country. The subtitle of the book is What Eastern Europeans Can Teach Us. And so at the end of every chapter, there's a little short summary of kind of the ahas I took away. What do Romanians do better than most people? What do Bulgarians do better than most people? Every single country has that. But most of all, it's to help people understand what's the difference between a Slovenian and a Slovakian. What's the difference between a Lithuanian right. and a Latvian? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of misconceptions and myths about Eastern Europe. It's a vague part of Europe that a lot of people don't know. So that's why I call it the Hidden Europe. It's just this part of Europe that we just don't go. A lot of times when people say, hey, Chris, I'm going to go to Europe. What do you think? You think Spain, France, Germany,
right. sure.
you
know, mm-hmm.
England? Nobody thinks of, oh, you're going to Europe? Oh, that's Moldova, right?
right.
Oh, Bosnia. Okay, yeah, sure. It's just not the first thing on our lips. And there's a lot of misunderstandings. And I'm guilty of it, too. 20 years ago, when the Yugoslav wars happened, I had no clue the difference between a Croatian and a Slovenian and a Bosnian and a guy from Kosovo. It's all mysterious to me. And so I really want to go there and kind of unravel and peel away this onion and try to understand it. And I share that with the readers in this book.
Excellent. And I did enjoy, you mentioned talking about the best parts of every country. Yours is not necessarily a every place is happy, happy, let's paint it as golden light as you can. But on the other hand, you did manage to see the best, I thought, in the various people. And I enjoyed that part of the book.
Yeah, that's a good point, Chris. Trying to be a realistic book. I mean, a lot of guidebooks. And
I'm going to get you're going to get some grief for that, because a lot of guidebooks, you're right, are why this is the best place. And, you know, the tourism board would love every guidebook written about them. And that's not always a good service to the traveler.
That's right. Exactly. And I am definitely going to get a lot of grief. I'm probably going to get a lot of grief for this podcast from Russians who don't like me saying certain, you know, any kind of negative things. And it's tough. It's the old saying, you know, I can call my, well, it's not an old saying, I just made it up, but I can call my daughter a slut, but I don't want you to call her a slut. In other words, I don't want somebody to criticize America because it's my country, but I can criticize America all I want. And so people are very touchy about the subject, and I will get a lot of grief for it. But I do think I paint the good, bad, and the ugly in every country. And I think every country has wonderful aspects, and I try to capture that. And some countries have some less desirable, little rougher on the edges. And we all have that. And so,
right.
like you say, it's a disservice to just try to paint a rosy picture of how great this country is. And then you get there, and you're like, wait a second, it's not as great as I expected.
And we should say, in terms of this podcast, and we had talked about, I don't know, 8 different places that Francis and I might talk about. And basically, he chose Russia, or he chose the European portion of Russia. And you chose it, as I understand it, because you loved it.
That's right. And I do love going to Russia, and I can't wait to go back again. At the same time, I want to set realistic
right.
expectations of certain events for people. When I first got there, I wish somebody had told me about. But I do highly recommend going to Russia. And I think it's something that's going to be very important to kind of understand, because going forward in the future, I mean, Russia is going to continue to have a huge influence on the world. And one of the problems with the American media and even the Western European media is that we still kind of have this kind of Cold War mentality in our brains. And I think Russians, give them a lot of credit. They're better than us in that respect. I think, yes, there are Russians who still kind of have this Cold War mentality, but they're much better at kind of putting away the past than we are in the United States, where we tend to still look at Russian with such skepticism and criticism. And to me, it's just stupid. You know, here they are. They're a capitalist economy. There's no ideological fight anymore. Why can't we be friends? I mean, for God's sake.
One of the largest democracies in the world, yeah.
That's right. And we're friends with Saudi Arabia, for God's sakes. And we can't be better buddy-buddy with Russia? I mean, to me, there's a lot more common that we have with Russians than a lot of the countries that politically the United States is in bed with. And so to me, it's time that we kind of put away these habits that we have. And the best way to do that is for Americans to go to Russia and actually talk to Russians and meet them and hang out with them and spend time with them. And to me, that will be a lot the best way to move our relationship forward and to have a better mutual understanding. And by the way, they benefit too. When you go there and you're an ambassador, when you go travel as a tourist, you have to go there and put the best face forward and really show that Americans are not, whatever misconceptions they may have, Americans might be wrong as well. So that's one of the reasons I also think it's a great time to go to Russia.
Excellent. Well, Francis, thanks very much for coming back on the show. I won't be surprised if we have you back on again. There's certainly a number of places that we thought about talking about. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks again, Chris, and pleasure to come back again sometime.
And our guest again has been Francis Tapon, and the book is The Hidden Europe.
I'm going to skip the news of the community this week. Between having a cold and having spent literally 7 hours doing interviews today, I'm going to try and preserve what voice I have. But I will tell you that we will probably skip a show in the next couple weeks as I'm heading off to China on Tuesday. If you have any questions about this show, feel free to leave a comment at amateurtraveler.com on this episode or send me an email to host@amateurtraveler.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, @Chris2X. And as always, thanks so much for listening.